Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. So let's talk about the 26th of August, 2023. It's about 12:45 p.m. in the afternoon. Dana Burton, she is just going about her everyday business. She's handing out leaflets on Boscombe Seafront. She's walking up the manor steps zigzag in the direction of the coastline to Boscombe Cliff Road. Nothing untoward has happened to her that day. Nothing out of the ordinary has occurred. But boy, is this going to change very quickly. So she's walking along, and then suddenly there's this really heavy downpour of rain. Now, for those of you who don't frequent the UK, you won't be aware of how much we like the rain here. We're very green and pleasant. That's what the land is said to be. And that's because we have a ton of rain all the time, even in summer, often in summer. And so this is not unusual that you're in the height of the seasonal summer experience and all of a sudden you're all but drowned in an onslaught of a downpour of heavy rain. But it feels like at this moment in time, because of the impact on the land, certain things are going to be dislodged, and Dana is going to discover that very quickly. So she ends up seeking shelter under a tree. She waits there for about 5 minutes, and at this point, this really large package just basically lands in front of her. Now, initially, you can imagine in that moment, psychologically, you're just standing there, minding your own business, there's a heavy downpour of rain, and then, wow, this large package has just basically landed in front of you, and she immediately thinks someone's thrown something towards her, so she runs away because she's worried that somebody is kind of pinpointing her and throwing things in her direction. Now, she has a look around after she's kind of ran and got herself back together. And so she thinks to herself, okay, maybe it wasn't that somebody threw something at me. Maybe the rain pour has actually dislodged whatever this package was. So she basically heads back towards it. And the moment that she heads back towards it, the first thing that becomes clear to her is there's this really bad smell emitting from it. And automatically she thinks there's something inside this and it's rotting. Now, most of you will know on this channel, and certainly in general, I'm sure many people will understand this is the reality. When you can smell something rotting, it triggers something in your brain, and it triggers something in your brain because it's about a survival mechanism. So if you smell something rotting, it's giving you an immediate message: do not go near. Now, if you think about human corpses and when they rot, that's even an additional trigger. And the additional trigger is it's not safe for a human being to be here. Remove yourself from this situation. So that mechanism to recognize the smell of rotting corpses is powerful, because you can think to yourself back many, many, many aeons ago, when we didn't have things like the internet to inform each other of threats, or we didn't have the modern world where we had police officers, etc., to be around to protect us. What we needed was instinctual reactions to things that could be dangerous for us, and this is a signal of danger. So she can smell something really off, but immediately she thinks to herself, well, it looks like somebody's maybe hit a dog, or maybe there's a dead fox in there. So she leaves that package along the road and she continued working, walking along, giving out those leaflets. And that makes perfect sense for most of us. We're going to assume exactly what Dana has assumed. Now, it's about 15 minutes later. She actually walks back down the zigzag, And at this point, she notices that the package has actually moved. And also, the grey masking tape that seemed to be holding it together, it looks loose. So she thinks to herself, I'm going to go and take a look. She just has that human curiosity to take a little bit of a deeper inspection around this package. And when she does, she is absolutely horrified because she can make out a shape inside the package that looks like a human foot. So this is absolutely terrifying for Dana, and she does exactly the right thing. She immediately notifies the police. This happens at 1:10 p.m. that same day. It doesn't take long for them to get there. It's not often, let's be honest, that the police get a call saying, I think I found a human foot in a package on the street. And if she's right, and this is actually a human foot and not the foot of a mannequin or not something that's been identified incorrectly, the police ultimately know that they're dealing with a homicide. Now, the responding officer who arrived immediately said the smell was pungent. And again, these individuals who work in the forces, they are schooled in this area. They understand when a smell happens to be emanating from a package like this, particularly when somebody's identified something that looks human, they are potentially dealing with something incredibly serious. They use a penknife just to go ahead and open the package a little bit more, obviously not wanting to damage any forensic evidence. But the minute that officer does it, they find a partial leg and foot. And it's very clear that the leg's been very rudimentarily cut at the mid-thigh. The leg was actually in a black bin bag and it had grey tape wrapped around it. Now, the police then get together, bring in more officers, obviously get the forensics there, and they start to deal with what is now a crime scene. And they decide that it's going to be important to search the surrounding area because obviously there's only part of a body here. And it could be that other areas of the body have been discarded elsewhere, but it could be that they've all been placed together nearby. So they start looking around, they climb over a nearby fence. This is towards an area of undergrowth, and they come across a similar package. So immediately they know they're dealing with another area of the body. It goes without saying, these are similarly wrapped packages in the similar area and they're emitting a horrible smell. And they're right, it contains a leg and that leg's been cut at the mid-thigh. Now the police believe that the reason that those packages had ended up in front of Dana was that the rain had dislodged the body parts from where they were initially hidden. And now the police have these body parts. The most important thing that they have to figure out is who they belong to. Who is this victim? So they go about doing some DNA tests. And of course, not everyone is going to have a DNA profile out there. If you haven't been convicted of a crime or you haven't signed up to particular sites where people can track your DNA, well, it's going to be an uphill struggle. But after they take a DNA profile from muscle tissue of the legs that have been found on that path, they do actually get lucky and they find out that those legs belong to a 49-year-old male named Simon Shotton. So now they have the man, the victim, but they have absolutely no idea at this moment in time how on earth he has died and how he has ended up there.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Now, the obvious mindset is this is a homicide victim who's been dismembered and obviously disregarded. I suppose there is a possibility that he could have died naturally and somebody has decided that they don't want to be implicated in anything untoward and they're worried about being cast as a potential suspect in this death. So they just get rid of his body. So they have to figure out exactly what they're dealing with. But in the meantime, they try to find out a little bit more about who Simon Shotton is and also about how he's ended up in this horrific situation. Now, Simon Shotton, he's originally from Ipswich in Suffolk. And when you hear and read about his life, you can see he had had struggles from a relatively early age. But what people who knew him said was he was a really hard worker. He always tried to take agency. He got jobs on the fairground. He got warehouse work where he could. I've read people actually saying that he was one of the kindest people that they'd ever known, that even though he had big problems psychologically and with dependency issues, he always made time for people. He was the type of person that you could tell your struggles and he would genuinely listen and take on that burden if he could and help you if he could. But he had sadly had his life blighted by drug and alcohol dependency. That doesn't mean that he became completely lost from the people who loved him. He did his best to keep in touch with his family, especially with his mum and also his sons, but his contact with them was limited because of the transients and because of the issues that dependency throw up. And that's not to say that you do not have options in your life. Of course, Simon Shotton should have done a better job of getting clean and being present for his children and for his mother and anybody who loved him. That goes without saying, but sometimes people just can't find ways forward. And it does seem that, as opposed to what a lot of people will talk about dependents like, as if they were individuals who essentially met their fate accordingly because of their choices, and basically there was a level of frustration towards him. It doesn't feel like that in this case. A lot of people talk about him as if he was quite a wounded, sensitive soul, and the choices that he made were to self-medicate some of his personal pain. And even when he did that, he still had the relationships that he held with people who loved him. And whilst they weren't perfect, they were certainly drenched in love. And I think that's really important, because if I don't make that clear at the beginning of this, I think it's really easy to stereotype that Simon Shotton was somebody who maybe had an egocentricity and selfishness about his actions and behaviour, and that is not tallying with what people say about him. Wesley, his 19-year-old son at the time, he described his father as a loving father who was genuinely doing the best he could for his children, considering the circumstances he was living in. And he said, he wasn't present for most of my life, but one of the things that he appreciated about his father was that he did try to shield him from his addiction, from his dependency issues. So his son is very forgiving and understands the way that Simon Shotton was in a context that might differ from somebody just looking in with a judgment, i.e. he saw his father as someone who knew he had issues and he didn't want his children to have to confront those issues, face those issues and deal with the issues that he would bring into their lives because of his dependency. And Simon was addicted to really heavy duty drugs. So he was addicted to heroin and also crack cocaine. Now, even independently, those drugs are highly addictive, and the time that your body metabolizes those drugs is relatively quick. And that means that after you've got your hit, you are looking for your next hit. I've worked with people in drug dependency and in working with addicts, and they talk about it being a full-time job, literally. You get your hit, and then as you're starting to come down of your hit, it's all about going and getting another hit, and that means getting the money to achieve that, and that can lead you into making some really terrible decisions. And it can also mean that, of course, your life is entirely destabilized because a lot of people don't want to be around you who would once have cared deeply for you, because the dependency makes you turn into somebody that they don't necessarily feel comfortable around, or even at times like. This then led to crime. He needed to pay for his habit. So he falls into the company of people who realize that he's quite easy to exploit. So he ends up getting used as a runner by drug gangs. Now, when you talk about the word runner versus dealer, runner is the lowest grade. I mean, children are runners. So if you think about the county lines, drug issues, we're seeing 12, 13-year-old boys and girls being used essentially as runners to transport drugs to people who are requiring them in that moment. They take the money off that person, go back to the main person, hand over the cash. Sometimes they might receive some remuneration, sometimes it's just about increasing their reputation, and sometimes they'll actually just be given drugs as payment. But you're the lowest of the low, it's as simple as that. And he is an adult, but he is doing this work. And that's because the drug dealers realize that he has a weakness, and the weakness is drugs. If you want to be high a few times a day, then you're going to need an income that's going to enable that to happen. If you can become a runner for drugs for somebody else, and they're going to hand over drugs to you, that alleviates at least one problem. It means that you can get your hits regularly, and that's what basically starts happening. Now, in April 2020, Suffolk Police ended up searching Simon's house in Woodbridge Road, Ipswich, and they indeed found a lot of drugs. So 188 wraps of heroin and crack cocaine. So you're not going to get away with it as personal use in that moment. The police aren't going to be like, oh, you just want to individually make sure that these wraps are there so you know exactly how much you've got left. You don't intend to sell them to anybody else. You just want to make sure that you've got 188 days worth of it all measured out so you don't overdo it. You know, no one's going to see that. It absolutely looks like you have an intent to supply. At this point, he is indeed found guilty of possession with intent to supply. He was actually only given a 2-year suspended sentence, which I think strongly indicates just how full prisons are. I mean, 188 wraps of heroin and crack cocaine, that's a lot of drugs, realistically. I know on a weight level, it may not be, but when you consider the impact on society, the ramifications are pretty big. So he was found guilty at this point of possession with intent to supply, and he was given a 2-year suspended sentence, and that ideally would give him the consequences that he needs to realise that if he does anything wrong, he's going to end up behind bars. But obviously, when you have a drug dependency issue, it's not necessarily as easy as thinking, oh, I've got off relatively lightly this time, I need to check my behaviour. And that's why on the 1st of February 2022, he actually appears once again at Ipswich Crown Court. This time he's charged with possession with intent to supply Class A drugs, heroin and crack cocaine, and he was charged with possessing a bladed article in a public place. So at this point, he is sent to prison because he had a suspended sentence initially, but in September 2022, he is indeed released on licence. Now, I would say that the police and the probation service genuinely considered him to be a very vulnerable person. He wasn't a hardened criminal. He wasn't a hardened drug dealer. There was just something about his nature, a sensitivity about him that meant that he was an individual who was considered at risk. Also, he was talking to his probation officers about the fact that he had drug debts. He was basically being threatened with violence if he didn't pay. And the problem is he didn't have any means to repay the debts. And that means that his life genuinely could have been at risk because these big drug dealers, they're not happy when you can't repay the debts. And they like to make examples of people. And also they like to make examples of people who don't necessarily have the support mechanisms around them. That means that when they disappear, shall we say, people are chasing the outcomes of what's played out. So the consequence of that is Simon could have been absolutely at risk of being made one of these examples. So they actually end up relocating him to Dorset. It's not actually clear how much support Simon did receive from the probation services when he came back to the southwest, because one of the things that's very notable is he was homeless for a while. And there is nothing worse, is there, than being in a scenario where your life is challenging because of a dependency issue, and then your lived conditions are incredibly challenging too, because you're going to want to escape. So if you're freezing cold and on the streets, then it makes sense that if a hit of drugs is going to make you forget that for a short period of time, that's going to be an incentive to go ahead and take whatever drug you are addicted to. So because he hasn't got the support mechanisms around him, a place that's safe to stay, it is going to encourage him to go back down paths that really, ideally, he should be avoiding. So he's homeless. Then he stays in a derelict remains of the Mon Bijou Hotel on Manor Road that had actually been boarded up for about 10 years. So essentially, he stays there for a period of time. Now, according to a probation officer that he used to talk to very openly and honestly, the building was apparently in the process of being renovated, but it was at the point that he moved in very, very run down. And it seems that whilst he didn't have some tenancy agreement with the people who owned that property, and he definitely didn't pay any rent to live at the address, there was some kind of informal agreement for him to stay at the address. And the reason for this is the people who owned it wanted to deter squatters. And this is certainly something that we see play out. Lots of places where organisations, even those who have big buildings and do this professionally, get people who don't necessarily pay rent to come in and stay at the address to make sure that people don't break in and essentially get squatters' rights. So this is what he's doing. But clearly, it's not ideal. It won't have the amenities and the hygienic environment that is required when you're trying to deal with a dependency issue. But in spite of this difficulty, in spite of these challenges, in spite of the fact that it must have been really cold and at times really disheartening to be in the position that Simon is in. He still went to his appointments with his probation officers, and he was said to really build an excellent rapport with them. And again, that speaks to a side of his nature that is clearly desperately trying to change, desperately trying to engage, and wanting a better life, essentially. Sadly, by late spring 2023, Simon had actually relapsed into drug use, and he was drug running for a county line. And the reason for that is, as I said earlier, he was trying to get drugs for himself. He was made to work literally 12-hour days. He would be street dealing because he wanted to make sure that he could get his hit. So he was being very much controlled by people higher up the chain. They knew they could get away with just paying him in drugs, not money. And drugs only meets the need of one element of who you are in that moment. It doesn't feed you, it doesn't clothe you, it doesn't keep you safe, it doesn't keep you warm. But it is going to be the priority psychologically of the addict. The most important thing that they need is their next hit. And those absolutely horrible human examples that I've just talked about of those drug individuals who deal and often don't use themselves and exploit people with genuine problems, not even allowing them money, instead just feeding them more of the very thing that's destroying them. That's what's happening in this situation. The probation service at this point are unaware, and that means that they can't intervene. Now, the police end up conducting inquiries into Simon's last known address, because clearly his body's turned up. No one knows where he's gone. Nobody necessarily knows who he's been living with. It feels like he just vanished, and now his limbs are literally appearing on a pathway. So they're able to look at his last known address. This is through going through the probation service's notes. And they're given a telephone SIM card number as well. And this is his last notified address, and it's in Manor Road, Moscow. So they go and look around that particular building, and it's derelict. It's empty. The man who did own the building said to the police, listen, we needed to get the site cleared, so I asked Simon to move on. Which again, would be in line with what he's told the probation officers, that he's staying there to prevent squatters moving in, and the consequences, there's going to be a point where he's asked to leave. He even, this guy who they're speaking to about where Simon had gone, if he had any information about him, showed text messages between himself and Simon on the 10th of August, and that's about getting his possessions sent to 18 Aylesbury Road, Moscow. Now, this is a big deal, because it's really hard to track somebody who's transient like Simon. And of course, if those text messages hadn't existed, no one would have a clue where Simon had gone on to next. But fortunately, those text messages clearly demonstrate he was moving to 18 Aylesbury Road, Boscombe, or whoever lives there is aware of who he is and was receiving his possessions. So at this point, the police also try to locate Simon's phone. They actually see that the phone data revealed the last call was made at 5:25 p.m. on the 18th of August to a landline number, and that landline number belongs to a cash creators on Boscombe High Street. Now, if you don't know what a cash creators is, in the UK we have lots of these, but some of them are called cash creators, some of them are called other names that are very much about giving you an idea that they're going to be able to hand over money very quickly. It's basically a way of going in and getting cash by selling your goods. It's as simple as that. So the reason they're a cash creator is you're going to walk in with a phone, they're going to give you a really bad price for it, you're going to walk off with a tenner and they're going to sell it for 50 quid. It's as simple as that. So the police then go to the shop, and indeed, and very fortunately, they find Simon's iPhone SE. At this point, it gets even better, because just like you'd expect in shops like this, they have regular customers and the staff recognise them. And they actually were able to say to the police, listen, we know exactly who brought this phone in. It was a woman named Debbie Pereira. Apparently a very regular customer, often coming in selling random items. We're going to throw it out there, aren't we, right now? We're going to say Debbie Pereira came in with stolen items. That's why you come in with random items, because you've nicked them from someone. And believe me, Debbie Pereira is somebody who is stealing on a daily level. So she'd brought in this iPhone and she wanted cash for it. The police are then able to access the CCTV, and indeed it shows Debbie Pereira selling the phone, and she's with another man, a guy called Benjamin Atkins. And it is actually quite incredible when you think of what I've just said regarding this investigation. They have found limbs on a path. They don't know who they belong to. There's no identifying features in that moment. They're able then through DNA to figure out exactly who that body belongs to, which is pretty astonishing anyway. But now, through that good old detective work, not only have they found out where he lived and the last address he was present at, they've even found the CCTV of the two people who had one of his items. So now they have at least people they want to speak to as potential witnesses, or indeed they could be looking at two suspects involved in Simon's demise. So let's talk about the two people that the police have now discovered had his phone. So Benjamin Atkins, well, he was 49 at the time of Simon's murder. He was born in Oxford on the 17th of October, 1974. He lived there with his mother, his stepfather and his brother. Apparently, Atkins's stepfather was horrible. He was very physically abusive. He was very emotionally abusive. And that makes Atkins a victim. And we can have absolute sympathy and empathy and compassion for him. No child should grow up with a bully and an abusive individual like his stepfather. And it's terrible that that was the case.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Case. He went to Sherwell School in Oxford. Oxford's a lovely area of the UK, but in spite of the fact that he probably could have achieved an education, this didn't play out. At age 15, he left with no qualifications. So one can say there was probably some dysfunction there. Maybe he wasn't attending very regularly. Maybe his home life was so traumatic that he really didn't have time or care for studying for qualifications because just surviving was challenging enough. He also went on to describe himself as a casualty of the 90s rave culture. And for somebody who grew up in rave culture like myself, I can absolutely see how people can become casualties of that. It was very much a loose era. There were a lot of recreational drugs, there were a lot of warehouse parties in the UK. We kind of got lost in a sea of music, in the Manchester world, in the cool Britannia climate. And a lot of people genuinely did feel that the introduction to recreational drugs became something far more sinister for them over time. And that's how he feels he ended up in that situation. Also, in the year 2000, Atkins's grandma died, and apparently he was very close to her. He found that very, very hard. One can imagine that he had big issues around attachment. Bear in mind that he had a horribly abusive stepfather. She must have given him a foundation of support and love. And to lose that when ultimately you haven't felt it in other arenas and you're struggling with the things that go on in your world emotionally, psychologically, physically, and in this case, in home life, that understandably is going to hit him very hard, and it does. Now, as a result, he believes that that sent him to self-medicate and that this is one of the reasons why he ends up in a drug treatment centre in Weston-super-Mare. Now, with respect, it feels like losing his grandma and going through that grief process really did highlight to him that he needed to change his life. So he ends up going into a drug treatment centre in Weston-super-Mare. So he actually manages to get clean. He even trains as a carpenter, which is amazing. And I wish that that was where his story ends in this way, because it would be so positive. It's hard to get over dependency issues. It's hard to deal with challenging grief issues. But here we are in a situation where he's taken responsibility. He's forged some resilience. He's trained in a new career. But that only lasts till 2005. And then Atkins relapsed. Now again, he gets clean in 2008. This is when he attends a rehab centre in Bournemouth. So he's trying, he's trying, he's trying. But like we see often, these things happen for a period of time. And then if you haven't really worked through what it was that pushed you down that line into dependency, you never really resolve the root cause. And that means that when you face new challenges, that root cause can surface again. He even has some really serious health issues in 2021. He has a stroke. It actually took him 6 months to recover. And according to Debbie Pereira, who was his girlfriend, she said that aside from the stroke, aside from those issues, aside from the fact that he obviously has some very debilitating concerns on a physical level, he also was paranoid schizophrenic and he had depression. So it seems as if he could have had a whole host of problems at that point in time. Now let's talk about Debbie Pereira, his girlfriend, and the other suspect in this case at this moment in time. She was born in Johannesburg in South Africa. She was born on the 14th of December 1984. She ends up getting adopted by her aunt. And the reason for this is that her mother is very young when she has her. So obviously there's some lack of stability right from the get-go. And then it's awful for her. She's subjected to physical abuse by her adoptive father. She's subjected to sexual abuse from her father's friends from a really young age. So this woman is absolutely failed as a youngster. She is a child who is abandoned by all those who are meant to protect and care for her. And it was said her life was entirely loveless for the most part. Now, at the age of 14, she ends up moving to the UK. And again, her criminal record, I would say, is not a serious criminal record regarding what she's getting involved in. It's petty, but nonetheless, she has lots and lots of run-ins with the law, and she is charged with lots of petty offences. And that says that she isn't able to think about the consequences of her actions, and also the consequences to those actions don't change her behaviour. So that demonstrates that she is not somebody who feels that the rules apply to her, or she has needs in her life that mean, in spite of those rules that should apply to her, she's not going to follow them because she needs to get from A to B. In this case, she needs to get from A, her need for drugs, to B, receiving the drugs that she feels that she requires. But she certainly had a lot of offences to her name. Now, age 29, Pereira began dating a man who basically ends up introducing her to heroin. So she's in a situation where she's had all of this collateral damage in her life. She's been through horrible abuse. She's been sexually molested, and I would say trafficked, to her adopted father's friends. And she's likely devastated by the trauma that's occurred to her, and she's looking for an escape. And heroin is going to alleviate that pain for a temporary period. So she starts taking heroin, and it will no doubt work effectively in that moment for removing herself from the agony of her experiences from the past. And so then, of course, she begins the life of crime to fund her habits. She ends up calling the police out as well many times, because whenever she's in relationships, she just falls victim to individuals who are violent. So all of the relationships that she has involve domestic violence. Now, I will note that when she meets Atkins, he isn't physically violent towards her. He's the only one in her relationship history who does not attack her on a physical level. That doesn't mean, of course, that he isn't controlling. It doesn't mean that he's nice to her. It just means that he isn't comparable with the violence that she's endured and experienced in prior relationships. She also had two children. They were aged 19 and 16 at the time of this crime, and she did have intermittent contact with them. But of course, it's really sad, isn't it? Just like she being born into that really dysfunctional situation where she hasn't encountered a life of stability and a foundation of security. And so too, she's repeated that cycle with her own children. They haven't had her in their lives as they deserve to have her in their lives. It's as simple as that. She's chosen drugs over them. She was also diagnosed with PTSD, which is completely unsurprising when you consider what I've told you about her childhood. Who wouldn't have post-trauma? Also OCD, so obsessive compulsive disorder. She was also said to have issues around food. I have looked at videos of her, and I would say that she was very, very slim to skinny. So the likelihood is that she struggled with eating, or she had potentially things like bulimia, but there were issues around her food and the way that she used food as a coping strategy. And when you consider the sexual abuse, when you consider the fact that she was just abandoned in so many ways as a child, it makes sense that those conditions are present. It's very, very hard when you're dealing in a situation without any control, when you've got a level of helplessness, when everything that happens to you, you have absolutely no power to stop, that eventually down the line, you'll find mechanisms to cope. And if you consider her childhood, which was so devoid of love, it was so devoid of safety, then something like OCD and developing OCD, whilst from the outside looking in, people were like, well, what would ritualistic thinking or checking your door is locked 100 times, what would that do to make you feel more secure? Well, it's because you're trying to think about how you can stop bad things happening in the future, and you have to go through these ritualistic beliefs to ensure that by doing that, you protect yourself or your family. And it doesn't make sense if you're outside of this scenario. When you're in it, it absolutely makes sense to you. And PTSD, of course, trauma, when you've been horribly sexually molested and sex trafficked in this way, you are going to be in scenarios where things can trigger you back to that moment, because at the end of the day, your life was shattered in a place and space which was meant to be secure. So then we get to September 2021. This is after she leaves a dry house. She's been in a rehab centre and she ends up moving into 18B Aylesbury Road. Now, a neighbour of her said that she was a really friendly person. She presents herself quite nicely. She's a relatively attractive woman. And she didn't cause them any alarm. There weren't issues regarding her living at the address and being problematic. At this point, Pereira and Atkins have met and they move in together. Now, Pereira and Atkins meet at a drug rehabilitation program back in July 2018. Not the best place to meet somebody. I'm going to throw it out there, and there'll be people watching this video who say, well, that's very judgmental. I'm not being judgmental. I'm saying one of the things that a lot of people have to do when they work a program is acknowledge that they can't be around other people who have the same affliction or potentially may relapse at a point, because it will drag them back. So even though you go to these programs and you might have friendships in these programs, ideally you walk away from them once you're healed and you start a new chapter with people who are involved in sobriety more than anything else. Like I said, you can go to NA or AA, but you kind of go do the work and then go back out, and you don't spend a lot of time around people who may end up back in a situation that is deeply problematic. But these two, they end up keeping in contact after that program's ended. They don't actually begin a relationship until April 2022. And the reason for this is that Atkins has done the classic. He's looked on Pereira's Facebook posts. He's made a few comments on them. And she's obviously liked the attention. And he obviously has found her attractive. And they have this commonality and this history. And they get together at that point relatively quickly. And he moves into Pereira's house a few months later. Neighbours who knew them said, listen, from the outside looking in, they seem like a really happy couple. And it's also worth noting that Pereira said that she genuinely loved Atkins. She felt that she was, for the first time in fact, in a genuinely mutually supportive and loving relationship. She felt it was completely different from her previous relationships. He wasn't violent. He made her feel good about herself. She wanted to be with him. And it felt like a new beginning for her. Now, another neighbour, they said that once Atkins moved in, one of the things that they noticed was that she seemed to be getting thinner and thinner, and also she appeared more pale. Turns out that the worst case scenario was occurred and the couple have started using drugs together. So both of them end up relapsing. And of course, what you have there now is both of them have a problem, and the solution is obviously to get clean, but they now can look at the other person and get spurred on to go ahead and get in the drugs. So as opposed to it working positively, it works very negatively. Now, in order to fund the habit, because it's an expensive business, isn't it? Scoring drugs. Atkins ends up going out shoplifting, or he steals things, and then they take them to cash creators for extra money. And the reason that they're constantly scoring drugs is no one wants to go through withdrawal. Withdrawal is highly aggressive. It makes you very, very sick. It's physically traumatizing. So you are constantly chasing this high to prevent yourself ending up in that horrendous low of withdrawal. And it can also be really dangerous withdrawing when you're a high level dependent. It can actually mean that you die because it is so agonizing and so challenging for the body. So you have all of these reasons why if you're not going to go and get help, you're going to keep taking the drugs. So the police have done some background checks on Atkins and Pereira, and they realise that there is a strong possibility they are going to know something about what's played out regarding the demise of Simon, and indeed that they could potentially be responsible for his death. So on the 1st of September 2023, it's around 9:10pm, the police attend 18B Aylesbury Road. At 9:12pm, the police arrested Pereira on suspicion of murder. And wow, she looks really shocked. I mean, I would say that there's play acting here. Some people will watch this and think it's absolutely authentic. I think she's under the influence to a degree, and she's genuinely thinking, oh shit, things get getting real right now, and I just have to look like I have no idea what is happening. And you'll understand why that's my perspective in a moment. But certainly for me, even though she looks totally taken aback, I genuinely think she knows exactly why they are there. So it seems that when Pereira was asked the question, is there anyone else in this house, as opposed to her going, oh yeah, there is somebody, not in this house, not in the residence, but actually around the house, the garden, for example, which I suppose is included in this address, isn't it? Yes, the garden's included in the address. Yes, well, there's somebody in the garden. She didn't do that. She was like, no, there's nobody in this house at all. And I think she was being very cagey with the truth there, because as they go outside, it turns out Atkins is crouched behind a wheelbarrow and he's trying to hide from the police, which isn't a good look, is it? You know, if you've got nothing to hide, why are you hiding behind a wheelbarrow? Just throwing it out there. Also, why is your girlfriend denying that you're actually around? And also, why is she looking shocked that the police are there arresting her potentially for murder when she's acting in a really suspicious way? At this point, he's also arrested on suspicion of murder. Now, on the 2nd of September, the police end up conducting a search of the home properly. When they search the garden, officers are met with a really strong smell, a very familiar, easily recognisable smell. And indeed, they do find two black bin bags. These are located underneath the wheelbarrow that Atkins was literally found hiding behind. Again, a little bit on the incriminating side there, Atkins, isn't it? They open the bags and the investigators find two arms, seven around the bicep area. Just going to throw it in, the words bang to rights, dead to rights. There's nothing you can do in this moment but acknowledge that clearly these two have been involved in the demise of Simon in some way, shape or form. When they do the search of the Aylesbury flat where the couple are living, they centre this on the utility room. And the reason for that is in the doorway to the utility room, there's two separate bloodstains that have been found on the carpet. And when they do a DNA profile, it matches both of them to Simon. Also, they found that Simon's blood had collected in a pool on the utility floor and it seeped underneath the linoleum and the concrete that lay underneath it. So they could see that whilst they tried to dilute some of this with water, they tried to clean around it, they hadn't managed to do it very effectively. But nonetheless, it shows that they were aware there was blood there and they had intentionally to get rid of it. They'd just done a really bad job of it. Also, airborne blood particles found on the washing machine and on the top of the radiator, on the walls of the utility. They also found a darker magnolia paint had been applied in what they called a sporadic and haphazard way. So I'm imagining that as much as Atkins had trained as a carpenter, he hadn't got the memo on how to effectively decorate. I know, carpenter is to do with wood, but I always think that workmen do good jobs in a diligent manner, not according to Atkins, sporadic and haphazard. Also, they had painted the words, I love you, on it. So not only have they tried to cover up the bloodstains, they've actually tried to make it look like there was this really cute message. And I find that really sinister, because if you are aware that there is somebody's blood all over the walls and you've actually painted over it to try to prevent people from seeing it, and then you write the words, "I love you," over it, it's such a juxtaposition. The pureness of love versus the evil of murder. But there you go, that's what this couple had done. Now, CSIs said that there was definitely blood present on the wall and that that paint had been used to cover it up. Significantly, the police found that the blood in the utility room absolutely matched both Simon and Atkins. So now they know that both Simon and Atkins had been bleeding at some point. Police found very little blood in the garden. The only blood that they found was on the wheelbarrow, and that was the wheelbarrow that Atkins had hid behind. So the police concluded that Simon had been murdered and dismembered in the utility room. They were unable to confirm if he'd actually been dismembered in the garden. So I'm presuming that it was done in the utility room. There was very little blood in the garden, apart from that little bit on the wheelbarrow. So I think we can assume that that is the case. Now, the police were able to recover two saws from the house. That was a wood saw and also a red hacksaw. So the police start doing some more investigations about where they could have been purchased from or where they'd come from. And police actually find CCTV footage from the 19th of August 2023. And this is footage that shows that Atkins and Pereira had stolen a hacksaw from Wilco and were literally walking down the street with it. And they were recorded on CCTV doing that. So they now know that it's very likely this is the thing that was used to cut up Simon's body. So it really is piling up now regarding their guilt. They obviously need to interview Atkins and Pereira, and that happens at Bournemouth Police Station, but neither of them will tell the police where the rest of Simon's body is located. Atkins is just consistently providing a no comment interview. You know, the classic, "I'm innocent, I'm just gonna say nothing." If you're innocent, couldn't you just like say something that maybe proves you're innocent? No, can't say anything. I'm going to say no comment. But that just makes me suspect that you're guilty. No comment. But I think you're saying no comment because what you mean is I've got a lot to say if I were telling the truth and it would involve incriminating myself in a murder. You do have a very good point there, but I'm just going to say no comment. Honestly, I hate to say this, but in court, I'm sure that if they said that somebody had gone no comment throughout their interview, even if they'd been advised by their solicitor, I'd be like, I just think they're guilty. Even if people were like, "Well, no, Emma, I know you think they're guilty, but it was just under the advice of their lawyer." And actually, all the evidence points to the fact that they didn't do it, including the fact that they think they've got somebody else with the crime. Yeah, I think his beady eyes and the fact he went no comment should mean that we should just throw him in jail anyway. Let's just not take any risks. You know, I genuinely would struggle, and I get it, but I think it makes you look super suspicious. And also the fact that they're not being helpful. Simon's body has been dismembered. It's clear that the police are going to do a really effective job at getting the evidence together that's going to make it very difficult for either of these to plead that they're not guilty, at least of something. So why not admit where the rest of his body is concerned? It shows a lack of accountability, a lack of remorse, a lack of willingness to actually help the family of Simon come to terms with the horrendous loss. But no. Pereira, she did, however, give a lot of interviews. She gave multiple accounts, shall we say, over 5.5 hours of interviews. The sad thing about that is that whilst she did speak to the police, they were all inconsistent. So Pereira is just a liar, essentially. The fact that she can't stick to the same story, it indicates deception. Now, from those interviews, however, one of the things that they were able to draw out was that Atkins had met Simon a few months before he died. He was basically given Simon's number because he was looking for a drug dealer. And Simon was essentially a free drug dealer, you know. They were using Simon, paying him in drugs to go ahead and dole out the drugs to people who needed them. So it ends up that Atkins and Simon meet up at a derelict hotel that Simon's staying at. And when Atkins turned up, apparently Simon was throwing a knife into a tree stump. And Atkins said that he felt that the reason that Simon was doing that was it was in a way to try to intimidate Atkins. And that to me speaks more about Atkins. I genuinely believe that If Simon is throwing a knife into a tree stump, he's probably just going about doing that because he's bored, he's waiting for a guy to turn up, he's got a knife, he's just chucking it into the tree stump. I mean, it's not the most intimidating thing when somebody's got a knife stuck in a tree stump. You know, it's going to take some time to go over to the tree stump, get the knife. And in fact, if you're trying to be intimidating, keep hold of the knife. You've just thrown a weapon into a tree stump that somebody else can go and get. So I don't buy into that description by Atkins. And I actually think that this demonstrates what Atkins is seeing the world like. He's got a level of paranoia. He's got a level of suspicion. And watching Simon throwing that knife into the tree stump makes him feel that potentially there's a threat there, when I would strongly suggest there isn't. There is nothing about Simon's nature, from what people have talked about regarding knowing him and loving him, that demonstrates he was an aggressive or violent man. Now, Simon...
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On The Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On The Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Then tells Atkins and Pereira that as the building's owner was worried he was dealing drugs, he was actually getting kicked out of the building. He also says to them, I need somewhere to stay. Now, the motives behind Atkins and Pereira inviting Simon to come and camp in a tent in their garden, I can't confirm. Of course, I don't know the absolute motivations. Maybe they were compassionate people somewhere in their hearts and they thought, this guy needs somewhere to stay. He can come and camp in our garden. He can use the kitchen, go to the bathroom at times. And at the end of the day, we'll be doing him a good turn. But I think we can all agree it's far more likely they were thinking, drugs, money. This guy's got access to drugs. This guy's got money. And that's going to be our motivation. So basically what they say to him is, you can come and camp in the garden, but for that, you need to give us £40 worth of drugs. So they wanted heroin and crack cocaine every single day. Apparently, occasionally he did stay on the sofa in the living room. As I said, he could use the kitchen and bathroom, but he wasn't allowed to be in the house during the day. Initially, the arrangement works out brilliantly. Atkins and Pereira are receiving free drugs, so they're really happy. They don't have to worry about stealing all the time, or if they do steal, they don't need to steal as much, and they're always guaranteed drugs on a daily basis. And Simon, of course, is benefiting because he's given an address, so for claiming his benefits, for things to be delivered and so on and so forth. That's really helpful. You want an address, and also it's a humanising experience. People want to feel that they've got a place and space to belong, so it's working for both parties. But arguments begin. Remember, we're talking about three drug dependents. This is not the most cogent space on a psychological level. They're going to be having come downs. They're going to think, in particular, that Simon's got drugs that they want access to. And you can imagine that having a third party living, not necessarily directly in the home, but around the home, using the resources of the home, that everyone's going to start feeling that that person is getting more than they're getting. And you see that with the mentality of dependency. Everyone's really concerned that somebody else is getting a little bit more than them, and it can lead to really big frustrations and flare-ups. Now, this escalates even more when Atkins borrows money from Simon and he doesn't return that money. And that's a problem, because bear in mind, Simon has been in debt with drug dealers before. It's not a good place for you to be. So he wants that money back. And actually, rightfully so. You can't just borrow money from someone and just swan off with it. And it speaks of a disrespect level, and it speaks of an expectation that Atkins has towards Simon that he's gone ahead and done that. But Pereira ends up being forced to repay Simon, and she does that because she wants to keep the peace. Now, behind Pereira's back, however, Atkins then starts to blackmail Simon. So he starts telling Simon, listen, if you don't give me more drugs, if you don't do what I say, I'm going to report you to probation. Now, bear in mind, that would mean that Simon would end up going back to prison. So now, you've got Simon in this really challenging situation. He's being told by a man who invited him to the home, apparently to help him out, that unless he hands over drugs that he can ill afford to do, he's going to end up ensuring that Simon goes back to prison. So it's a really challenging situation for him. It must have been very, very scary. And apparently he became very distressed by Atkins's threats. But also he started to get really concerned about the way that Atkins was treating Pereira. Apparently, he was verbally abusive. He was very bullying towards her. And we already know that Pereira's benchmark for relationships is low. It's low. So she has been physically abused in prior relationships. She's dealt with violence from men. They've laid their hands on her regularly. Think back to her childhood. She'd been sexually molested by men, passed around by her adopted father's friends. So her expectation level of treatment is going to be on the floor. As long as he isn't beating her up and sexually violating her, it's better than any other relationship she's had. That's the sad thing about Pereira. Her expectations will be so low that literally she'll put up with people who are horrible to her as long as they're not violating her sexually or physically. But for somebody like Simon, who's been a very loving person, who's been caring to people in his life, yes, he's got his problems, but he has an idea of how you should treat people, he doesn't like seeing that. But Atkins isn't seeing any of this. Atkins doesn't care about what Simon is thinking regarding the way he treats his girlfriend. No, he's just annoyed with Simon because he feels that Simon's starting to treat the house like a hotel. Just going to throw it out there. Hotels usually don't have you camping outside. Usually the benchmark of a hotel is getting in and having a bed. Often you get breakfast included. You know, it doesn't feel like it was a hotel. And also, bear in mind, they had agreed to let him come to the home. They had agreed to let him stay in the garden. They'd agreed to let him use things like the bathroom and the kitchen so he could make food. And they were getting drugs for free for that. So it's really Atkins who's creating the issue here and nobody else. Now, bear in mind, we can expect there'll be some frustrations. They had a one-bedroom flat, it was very small, and apparently because of these tensions, they started small, the arguments, and it seems that these arguments steadily built up for about 2 to 3 weeks until the night of the 17th of August 2023. Now, on the night of the 17th to the 18th of August 2023, the arguments were really intensifying, and this was between all three of them. And it's actually evidenced in a text that's sent by Simon. This is at 12:06 a.m. And he sends it to a friend, a girl called Donna McGuire. And he basically says it's stressful where he's living. He feels really uncomfortable about where he was. He says that Atkins was really ungrateful. He said, in fact, he was an ungrateful, blackmailing, vindictive, two-faced wanker. So obviously very unhappy with the situation. Simon then says to Donna, is it okay if I stay at your house? And she did, with respect, offer for him to stay there from the following morning. That had been the 18th of August until the 21st of August. Then a text at 2:22 a.m. was sent to Donna from Simon saying he was definitely staying at Aylesbury Road. These messages were later deleted. Now, no one knows whether it was by Simon or Atkins, but it's strange that at one point he's saying, I'm going to be coming to you. The next that it's saying he's going to be staying at Aylesbury Road and apparently it's so awful. The fact that they're deleted does suggest in my mind that it was Atkins who deleted them. Also, it turns out that in spite of the escalation in their arguing, Simon, Atkins and Pereira all took drugs that night. And when they ran out, as they do, Pereira actually distracted Simon and then Atkins stole money from Simon's wallet, which is really low, isn't it? It's just a really low thing to do. And the fact that Pereira was happy to distract Simon in that way so that Atkins can steal the money, it just speaks of a really fractured type of personality in my mind. Now, they took the money around 4:30 a.m. and off they go to try and find some more drugs. Simon discovers the theft. So he's going to be really upset. They've been getting smashed together. Now they've disappeared. He realises they've been funding that disappearance, the new drug score, using his cash. So he rings them as they're returning back to the flat. This is just before 7 a.m. and he says, like, I want my money back. Now, when Atkins and Pereira get home, not only did they not give him the money that they'd stolen, they didn't share the drugs with him. In fact, they locked themselves in their bedroom and they took the drugs without him. Now, I know that when you are a drug dependent and you get hold of drugs, you often don't want to share them. I get it. But they've stolen his money. They've got his drugs, essentially, by buying them from somebody else with his cash. And now they are snaffling them all by themselves in their bedroom together. That is going to be so frustrating for Simon. That is going to feel like an absolute new low, respect-wise, towards him. because it's treating him in a really disrespectful manner that's resulted in him being out of pocket financially and now not even having the privilege of taking the drugs that they have scored. So at this point, Simon ends up texting another contact who he's working for. This is a guy that he sells drugs for. And he says, look, I need to move out of this address. I need to get away. And that person actually does arrange to collect Simon from the Aylesbury Road flat around 9 a.m. the next morning. And Simon actually texted him at 7:30 a.m. and said, are you awake? And he says, yeah, I'll be at your address within the hour. He was driving from Southampton. 7:35 a.m. Simon replies, the quicker the better, bro, before I end up going back to jail. And again, that makes sense, doesn't it? He's absolutely incensed. He's had his drugs stolen. He's had his money stolen, essentially. And now he just wants to get away because he's thinking, I'm going to do something stupid if I stay here. And it's also very notable to me that he wants to leave because he could just rip the place apart, couldn't he? He could kick off royally. He could attack Atkins and Pereira. He could do all of those things. All he wants to do is to get away. And that's the absolute right course of action. Now, at 7:50 a.m., Simon texts the same friend again saying, I have another little cunt who cannot keep his hands to himself. And he said that Atkins has stolen £30 from him. And then he said he'd cut the power cable on Atkins TV in revenge. Now, that's a very passive aggressive way of doing things, isn't it? I mean, it's annoying cutting somebody's TV power cable, but come on, it's easily replaced. But it's a way of him addressing the issues that have played out. You know, he's not making it physical. He just wants people to know he's annoyed. And yes, it's childish, but I also think what they've done to him is really awful. I don't think that people should be going out and scoring drugs and getting high, but I'm talking about the context of what they've done to Simon. It's just deeply disrespectful psychologically for him to have gone through that. Now, at 8:05 a.m., Simon actually sent his very last text to the friend. Now, 3rd of September, we get Atkins and Pereira, who are going to Poole Magistrates Court. And the reason for this is there's been an application made for further detention. Obviously, the police have to ask when they want to hold somebody for longer in questioning than they may initially have thought they'd need to. So at this point, Atkins and Pereira are placed in the same police van. And this is all about giving people enough rope so they can choose to hang themselves with it should they wish to. And these two are not, shall we say, the sharpest tools in the box. So the police have actually installed a covert listening device to record any conversations that play out between them. Atkins tells Pereira that it's illegal for the police to interview her while she's in withdrawals from methadone. So he's immediately letting her know, listen, you don't need to talk. If you are high on methadone, and she did have a prescription for methadone, you should not be being interviewed. He also asks her, do you know why I went into the garden? Now, Pereira speaks back to him immediately and says, did you have the legs there? Atkins then says to her, I went into the garden to get rid of the fucking arms. He's laughing at that point. Bear in mind, we're talking about the limbs of a human being, and he thinks it's funny. I mean, sociopath every day of the week. Simple as. I mean, we're talking about a man's life that was ended, and we're talking about this guy being amused by the fact he was caught in the garden and he was actually trying to get rid of the arms at the time. He also went on to say that the police would not find any evidence underneath Pereira's fingernails because of the, quote, amount of bleach you used, so incriminating her immediately. Just before leaving the van, Pereira actually asked Atkins if he regretted anything. He replied, I'll look them straight in the eye and say, yeah, I'd do it again and again and again. If you let me go today, I'll find another one and do it again. Drug dealers and pushers, kill, decapitate and eat the fucker. I mean, just gonna throw it out there. Those drug dealers exist because you buy it from them. I mean, if you got rid of all the drug dealers, I suppose you wouldn't be able to get drugs anymore. But Atkins, you seem like somebody who really wanted drugs and went consistently out of your way to score them, even if that meant blackmailing an individual so you could get more. Not really sure that the issue lies with the drug dealer in this case. I'm pretty sure it lies with you. He also said to Pereira, listen, you don't need to answer any of the questions the police ask about. Just say no. Comment. So now they have them. Basically, that's a confession, isn't it? That's saying we were involved. This man has been killed. We certainly were the last people to see him. And even though he's turned in his head into some kind of lawyer advising Poirier what to do and say, it's not going to hold any water because he's basically incriminated himself enormously in that conversation. We get to the 4th of September and you won't be surprised that Atkins and Poirier are charged with murder. They're also charged with perverting the course of justice and preventing the burial of a corpse. And absolutely, they should be charged with all of those things, in my opinion. I mean, the fact that they cut that man's body up. And just think about the family's perspective, knowing that you're never going to get to say goodbye to the person that you loved because they're in pieces. They've rotted away. They've decomposed to such a degree you cannot say goodbye. It is stealing, again, just as these two have done in so many different ways, it is stealing from a family. We get to the 6th of September. At this point, the police are basically conducting a massive search. And bear in mind, they were exhaustive in their search. They were commended as a force for the work that they put in to finding Simon's body. They really went out of their ways to bring him home for the family. So they've expanded searches throughout Bournemouth, and it's been described as Dorset's biggest search operation. It involved police teams from multiple different teams. At 10:53 p.m., police officers were combing an area of Bournemouth called Boscombe Chine Gardens. Officer is walking on the left of a path, and as he's doing that, he just recognises that horrifically distinctive smell of death along this raised embankment. He also notices as he's looking down that there are these black suitcases within a hedge, and another thing that's notable is they're surrounded by flies, so he can smell decomposition, he can see the flies, and immediately he thinks to himself, there is something clearly wrong here. Also notices the bottom of the suitcase is wet, covered in maggots. So the investigators are called. They open the suitcase, and at this point they find Simon's headless torso. So they found another part of his body, but again, horrifying. His headless torso is there, so his head isn't with it. At this point, the police are appealing to the public. They wanted any info on anyone who'd been seen with the black suitcase acting suspicious between the 18th of August and the 1st of September. So the police are beseeching the public because they want to bring Simon's body home. Now, on the 18th of February, it's 2024, there's a hearing at Winchester Crown Court, and it's about Atkins. So following the advice from his solicitors, Atkins has actually given a statement. And the statement is this. He says that Simon attacked him. So yeah, Simon is the antagonist, apparently. So he attacks him with a bread knife. They begin fighting. Atkins then gets some defensive wounds to both of his hands. And he said, yes, I did kill Simon, but I killed Simon in self-defense. He also, in this statement, horrifically admits to burning Simon's head in his back garden after dismembering him and disposing his body parts on Walpole Lane. That's an alleyway close to Pereira's flat. He also gave police images to identify exactly where he disposed of Simon's skull. So the story is now all self-defense, and he didn't mean for it to happen, and it's just a terrible, terrible accident that's occurred when he's been defending himself. To me, ludicrous on every level, and I'll tell you why. Because people do kill people by mistake. It happens. It's rare. It's really rare. But you know, if somebody's coming at you with a knife and you turn the knife on them, then with respect, you have a right to say it was self-defense. But if you then have repeatedly stabbed somebody or caved the head in or done something awful that seems like overkill, and then, shall we say, you've dismembered their body and throw their body parts all over the local area, that doesn't sound like self-defense. That sounds like you're trying to cover up murder. I mean, the last thing that anybody who has a brain cell is going to be doing in the moment where they've accidentally killed someone is to go, what I could do right now is I could ring the emergency services, I could ask for the police and the ambulance, they can come, maybe there's a chance to save this person. Ultimately, if they're dead, I'm going to be able to explain that, look at my defensive wounds, look at the fact that I was attacked, and yeah, I stabbed this person once, and look, they're dead, and it's terrible, and of course you're going to have to go through the motions of looking at whether I need to be charged with anything, but for the most part, I just need you to know, I'm holding my hands up, this is what I've done, but it was completely self-defense. That's where I'm going to be like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. It's terrible. Somebody's dead. It's an awful situation, but it kind of makes sense. The minute you're like, oh, I've killed this person, it was absolutely self-defense. So what I should do is dismember their body and just spread it all over the local area and burn the head in my back garden. That just doesn't sound very self-defensive. That sounds massively homicidal, with respect. We get to the 28th of February. At this point, police are searching the areas of Walpole Lane that Atkins has told them to go to, and they do indeed discover small fragments of skull that is located next to garages. They send them for analysis, and indeed it confirms they are human skull fragments. To be fair, in spite of the work that they did, all of Simon's head has never actually been found. So there's still pieces of his skull out there. Now, the unenviable autopsy was carried out by Dr. Deborah Cook. The final report was prepared on the 27th of October. It didn't provide a definitive time of death. Of course it didn't. It couldn't. The body had been spread all over the place, and essentially they're relying on the two suspects to tell them of what happened. So it can't conclusively be proved when he died. Dr. Cook confirmed that both of the legs found in August 2023 did indeed belong to Simon.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Amputations, she wrote, appeared amateur, definitely not surgical. They found maggots around Simon's legs and said that those maggots were natural with decomposition and that the amputation must have occurred with enough time for maggots to form. When Dr. Cook looked at the torso, she confirmed that there were bodily fluids on the suitcase, and the torso was found indicated bodily decomposition along with numerous maggots. There were 12 knife wounds on Simon's back. Now, again, bear in mind, Atkins is saying it's self-defense. 12 knife wounds on Simon's back. Now, if it's an accident, if you're defending yourself and you happen to kill someone, why would there be 12 knife wounds on Simon's back? These were located around his left shoulder. She couldn't distinguish whether the injuries were caused before or after death because of the decomposition. I would hazard, I guess, it was certainly before death. It appeared that Simon had been repeatedly stabbed with a small, sharp object, so likely a knife. When it came down to the arms, they'd also been sawn off. There were no needle marks on the arms, so at that point, not indicating that he'd been injecting drugs in his arms. There was an 8.5 centimetre cut on Simon's right palm, and it actually cut into the muscle, along with other small cuts. Simon's left wrist and hand contained 15 injuries, and the deepest wound was a cut to Simon's middle finger that reached the bone. So you can imagine defending yourself and getting hit again and again and stabbed by a knife. So Dr. Cook said they were defensive injuries, and particularly the wounds to Simon's forearms. Again, doesn't sound very much like he's the attacker, does it? You know, this is a guy who's defending himself and getting cut literally to the bone. And yet Atkins is claiming that it was Simon who was attacking him. It was also established that Simon's body had been dismembered with a saw. The left leg had been cut from back to front, the right leg cut from side of thigh to inner thigh. Also, there were partial cuts into the bone, and the pathologist believed that the saw had non-pointed teeth like a hacksaw. They basically looked at the shape, tooth spacing, and the profile of the blade, and they basically determined it was a TPI of 24. This actually matched the red saw that Atkins and Pereira had stolen from Wilco on the 19th of August 2023. So when they were caught on CCTV, they could see that that was indeed what had been used to dismember his body. They determined, therefore, that that saw had indeed been used on Simon's body. When the trial began, Atkins and Pereira were actually tried together. It began on the 11th of April 2024, and it was heard at Winchester Crown Court. The prosecution was led by Paul Calvin KC and Sam Barker. Atkins' defence was led by Zafar Ali and John Goss, and Pereira's defence was led by Ignatius Hughes. Atkins did admit that he had indeed perverted the course of justice and also prevented the burial of the corpse. He also admitted to killing Simon, dismembering him and disposing of his body parts. But he argued that he had killed Simon in self-defence. He denied murder. Pereira, well, she pled not guilty to all charges against her, which seems ridiculous because you're on CCTV with a saw and you're selling the items from the victim. And apparently you knew him quite well because he was living in your garden. Just going to throw it out there. I have no idea why she went not guilty to all the charges against her. The CCTV footage was, of course, a pièce de résistance. The jury has shown that footage and it just disputes Atkins and Pereira's ideas behind their defences, essentially, because it shows the movements on the night and the day of Simon's murder. So Atkins and Pereira are seen walking to Cash Creators around 11 a.m. to sell Simon's phone for £15. Also, they're shown footage from the 19th of August. Atkins is seen on Christchurch Road with a saw dangling from the bars of his bike. There was a statement, in fact, from Justin Witts. He was formerly employed at Wilco in Boscombe. He confirmed that the red-handled saw that Atkins was holding in the footage was indeed the same as the saws that they stock in Wilco's. Mr. Witt also added that one of their saws had been stolen that month. Also, the covert recording. That was that recording between the two of them in the van that was taken on the 3rd of September. It's totally damning. So the jury literally hear Atkins say, if I admitted that I cooked Simon's head and ate his cheeks, would it get me off the hook? The prosecution described the recording not just of what he said regarding the fact that Pereira shouldn't speak, the fact that he was laughing about being in the garden trying to get rid of the arms. It just proved to the jury that Atkins had a complete disregard for human life, and the prosecution went hard on that, and rightfully so. When it came down to the prosecution witnesses, well, Dr. Deborah Cook, the Home Office pathologist who conducted the autopsy on Simon's body, she confirmed that there were small puncture wounds clustered around Simon's left shoulder, also injuries to his wrists and hands, and these were very consistent with being defensive. She said that all but one of Simon's injuries could not have been self-inflicted. Dr. Atkins also took a look at pictures of Atkins' hands injuries and accepted that those could actually have been defensive wounds. She said that both sets of injuries sustained were compatible with an altercation where both men may have at times grasped onto a knife. So that, I suppose, is effective for both the defence and the prosecution. The prosecution saying, well, there you go, it's clear that Atkins was trying to stab Simon, and for the defence saying, well, no, this shows that Simon may have been attacking Atkins and that's why they both ended up with injuries. Now, the neighbours of Atkins and Pereira, they actually testified for the prosecution. And the reason for that is they actually smell a disgusting burning smell that they said was like burning flesh coming from their garden. So Atkins was questioned about this and he said, oh, I'm just burning a dead fox in the garden. I mean, again, just throwing it out there is a little bit on the suspicious side, isn't it? Even for those neighbours, like, sorry, what? Yeah, I've got a dead fox here. I just thought I'd barbecue it. Just going to throw it out there. It would have been, maybe not have been more appropriate. Well, I thought that and then I thought, you know what? I just thought I'd test whether maybe I can get it to a furnace level where, I don't know, I'm just left with powder and dust as opposed to bones and flesh. That's what I'm doing. I'm just going to back away now because I've always had my suspicions about you, Atkins. You know, it's not normal, is it? Also, another neighbour, and this is just horrendous, recalled hearing sawing and several loud cracks. That literally runs through my body when I say it. Another thing that the prosecution read out was an impact statement made by Simon's son Wesley, who was 19 when his father was killed. He said, I've known for a long time that life wasn't easy for my dad. Sometimes it seemed he struggled to show his true personality and character. He would use drink and drugs to escape the battles in his mind. He wasn't perfect. He made mistakes, but he tried to do things to better those mistakes. Whatever others may have thought of him, he was my dad. Love beyond words and irreplaceable to me. I never liked the idea of my dad being involved in drugs despite his struggles. He was my dad, who I was proud of. It's heartbreaking, isn't it, hearing Wesley say that? Because you're hearing a compassionate, forgiving young man who could see beyond the dependency and loved his father in spite of himself. And I think that that's a testament to a truly special young man. And I hope that his life and his brother's life is incredible. He also called Atkins evil. He said, "Your children should be ashamed of what you've done. You wrecked so many more lives than just my dad's. No sentence will ever be long enough for what you have done. There is nothing I can say that can truly capture what you have left me feeling. You knew what you were doing." So without a doubt, Wesley's saying you're guilty as hell. "I don't care what anybody brings into court. I don't care what I said here. You knew what you were doing. You killed my dad." Now, when it came down to the defence witnesses, Benjamin Atkins himself took the stand in his own defence. So he said, "Yeah, I killed Simon, but I killed him in self-defence. He attacked me. It was over an unpaid debt. He pulled a knife on me, and this is the consequence." He said, "Yeah, I did cut up his body in the garden under a makeshift tent, and then I burnt his head on a fire." He even went on to tell, I imagine, a horrified jury that when it took longer to burn his head than I expected, I wrapped the remaining body parts of him and disposed of them around Bournemouth seafront. He said, "I pulled his body into the garden, covered him up. Later in the evening when Debs was asleep, I went into the garden and I cut him up. I wouldn't have done that if I wasn't under the influence. I wouldn't have cut him up. I was scared. I was traumatised. I panicked. I was under extreme stress as well as under the influence." He said, "What I've done was truly awful. It's horrendous what I've done. And I deserve to be punished for what I've done. I'm sorry to his family. I'm sorry to my family. It's difficult for me to be remorseful to a man who was trying to kill me in my own house." You see, that's where everything Atkins says needs to just be, I don't know, put in an incinerator, which is something he has a particular penchant to want to do with other things. Because you don't say, "I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry," and then say, "But I'm not really that sorry because this guy was trying to kill me in my own house."
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Reflecting, and that speaks of a remorseless attitude. And if you are remorseless when you are not under the influence, if you are remorseless when you are standing in court admitting that you have murdered somebody, when you have killed somebody in such a diabolical way, to then say, "Oh, but I don't really feel that bad because he was trying to attack me." The overkill in this case is heinous, and I will tell you a little bit more about that when we come to the judges summing up. Now, when it came down to Debbie Pereira, she took the stand in her own defence. She testified that she played absolutely no part in the murder or indeed the dismemberment of Simon. She said that, "Yes, I did help Atkins out, but I did that out of fear for my life." She said, "I was terrified of what Ben Atkins might do if I didn't help him." Very convenient. I mean, a little bit strange that one minute you're saying it's the love of my life, this guy's never been violent towards me, and now apparently you're terrified for your life around him. Speaks to me of convenience, shall we say. So she said that Atkins had started to become increasingly violent, and then she became too scared to defy him when he began dismembering Simon's body. So she's classically going for that. "I did nothing wrong. It was nothing to do with me. I didn't know any of this had played out." She testified that, yes, a fight did break out between Simon and Atkins. She was then so scared that apparently she hid in the bedroom until Simon had been murdered. So clearly she went massively deaf and lost the capacity to, I don't know, call the emergency services, but this is her defence. She admitted then to cleaning up the crime scene. She also said she helped dispose of some of the body parts, but she said that her actions were driven by fear rather than complicity in the murder itself. Whatever, Pereira, whatever. With respect, I get it. She's coming out and acknowledging that this horrible thing played out. That's very helpful for the prosecution. But I just think this woman was 100% complicit in so many ways. Genuinely, I do. And I am a little bit frustrated by the sentence that we'll go into shortly. The verdict came on the 22nd of May 2024. The jury deliberated for nearly 21 hours. They found Atkins guilty of murder by a majority of 11 to 1. So it was a slam dunk. They all agreed, bar one person, that he was 100% guilty. They found Pereira not guilty of murder, but they did find her unanimously guilty of perverting the course of justice. Now, Kirsty Gordon, who's a senior Crown prosecutor with CPS Wessex, she made a statement after the verdict was announced. She said, "Atkins and Pereira's cruelty and lack of humanity is laid bare. after Mr. Shotton was murdered by Atkins in cold blood over a minor dispute, they robbed him the dignity of a proper burial. Absolutely correct. Absolutely correct. Now, when it came down to the sentencing of Atkins, Judge Stacey had to look at the mitigating and aggravating factors, and there were so many aggravating factors. So Judge Stacey cited the nature of Simon's dismemberment, saying the most serious aggravating factor is your dismemberment, concealment, and disposal of Simon's body after you had killed him. Your callousness was shocking. You still refused to say what happened to the rest of the head. She did accept that there was a lack of premeditation. She said, the violence that you then inflicted on Simon was ferocious and unnecessary. You must have quickly disarmed him and you used extreme violence against him in the counter-attack. Wholly out of proportion to the threat he posed to you. He posed little threat, in fact. He was weak with exhaustion from being worked so hard by the drugs gang. He had COPD, was in pain. He had restricted use of his right arm, and you were the far stronger of the two of you. Those who saw him in the days before he died commented on how tired and unwell he looked. He received several knife wounds to both his arms and hands from trying to defend himself, and he had 12 sharp force wounds to his torso, shoulder, and back. You admitted that the final blows that killed Simon were inflicted when you were on top of him and stoved his head in with a speaker several times after you had gouged his eye out with your thumb. He was no threat whatsoever to you at that stage, as well you knew. You told Miss Pereira that his last words were, "Help me." But instead of helping him, you killed him with the speaker. The pain he suffered must have been unbearable. You gratuitously told Miss Pereira that he had pissed himself as he died. You see, guys, this guy Atkins trying to suggest that it was self-defense, and yet those words in the summing up absolutely demonstrate it was not self-defense at all. It was murder beyond measure. The sentence he was given was life with a minimum of 19 years, and amen to that. Amen to that. When it came down to Pereira, the judge was quite scathing, shall I say. In fact, they said, you have a strong streak of narcissism. The remorse you purport to express is not genuine, but is self-pity for the situation you find yourself in. The focus of your attention was always yourself. It was a telling observation when you said that the reason why you showered before going out to sell his possessions after Simon had been killed and his body was lying on your floor was your concern you were sweaty and might smell. That judge also outlined many previous convictions that she had, not comparable to the one I've talked about today, but nonetheless demonstrating that she was a habitual criminal. She was sentenced to just 4 years. Genuinely, that woman has literally got off so lightly. I cannot quite understand why she got 4 years. I have known people go down considerably longer for miles less problematic actions. And it deeply concerns me that she gets 4 years because let's be honest, she'll be out in two. Let's be honest, where is the actual justice for Simon's family? I genuinely mean that. She allowed Simon to be murdered. And also, let me tell you, there were a lot of things in the sentencing comments that I read, which talk about the fact that she would often moan to Simon about the relationship that she had with Atkins. And she used him to unburden herself without any reciprocity at all. She's just a selfish, ego-driven woman. And she has her problems. And I feel sorry for her as a child. But what she has become is a grotesque caricature of the person that she should have tried hard to end up like. She is a disgrace, and I think that the law has allowed her to get off incredibly easily. I genuinely think if this was two guys who had been involved in this, we would have seen a much stronger sentence where she is concerned. What do you guys think? Do you think that they both got off a little bit too leniently? We all know that if we were talking about crime committed in the States, we're probably looking at much sterner, stronger sentences, maybe even life without parole, where Atkins is concerned. And will this actually make Simon's family feel that they've had justice served at all? I doubt it. My thoughts go out to all of them. Because I would imagine that they feel that there is a woman who is going to serve a pathetic amount of time in prison and just be able to carry on with her life. That somehow she is being considered a lesser party in this because she didn't deal the final blows, the dreadful blows that took Simon's life. But she absolutely was complicit in the crime. And now she's going to walk the streets again and potentially get into situations where she will once again find herself in scenarios where she's quite happy to have a man dismembered in her home address and essentially disregarded all over the local area because the boyfriend said it needed to happen.
Hi there, my name is Annie Elise, aka your true crime BFF and host of the podcast Serialously. I have been a true crime enthusiast forever, but I wished somebody would break down the cases for me like a friend, giving all the details and discussing every twist and turn. So I decided to create a podcast that does just that. Serialously with Annie Elise is topping the charts with over 1 million weekly downloads. I do the deep dives in these cases so you don't have to, diving into all the raw details, saying what we're all thinking, and in a conversational way, just like having a conversation with your best friend. So join me and let's talk all things true crime. Serialously with Annie Elise. New episodes drop every Monday and Thursday wherever you get your podcasts.